So, it's a great pleasure to be talking to you, Pat, after all these years, knowing each other for 30 years and so. I'd like to start. You obviously have a very interesting family background. Start with your family, parents, childhood and early education. Anything you'd like to say about that?
Right. Well, I came from, on both sides of my family, quite an ordinary sort of respectable working class, lower middle class background. And neither of my parents went to university. Indeed, my father left school at 14 and my mother at 16. But both of them felt that they would have liked to have had a much better education. And so they were incredibly supportive of me and my two sisters. And I suppose, to some extent, my academic achievements, such as they are, were kind of done vicariously for them. But I did have a role model, and that was my mother's very much younger brother, a kind of afterthought child, who, by the time he was born, the family had moved up a little bit in the world. There was a bit more money, and so he went to Oxford and he got a first in PPE. And he was the one who was always quoted and held up as the shining light of the family. So from a very early age, when people asked me, what are you going to do when you grow up? I would say, I'm going to go to Oxford like Uncle Walter. The other thing about my family, for all it was not terribly well to do, was the links with empire. And I think it's very interesting the extent to which the empire during the early part of, well, during the 19th and early 20th century, impinged on the lives of quite ordinary people. For example, my father's father went to India during the First World War. He was conscripted, or he volunteered, I don't know which, and he was in a number of the places that I know very well. And then his youngest son, my father's younger brother, also was in India just after the Second World War. He was too young to fight in the Second World War, but he was posted there in the Air Force. And then of course I was in India and our children have been in India. So there was always that link. And people talked about being, for example, in India. I had another uncle, my mother's older brother, who was in Ethiopia, and who brought back an extremely useful item that we three girls christened the camel stick. And when our parents went out in the evening, when we were old enough to be left, we were always a bit nervous, so we always had the camel stick handy. And actually my youngest sister still has the camel stick, because she says she's still nervous in the evening. So. And then there were objects around that these people had brought back from their travels, like there's a lamp over there which is shaped like a lotus that came from India, and it was always part of my childhood. Remembering it being there. So the notion that even ordinary people who wouldn't have gone abroad for holidays at that time when I was growing up, nonetheless went to places like India or Ethiopia, or in the case of my grandmother who'd been born in Australia and then her family moved back, and then the uncle who'd been in Ethiopia went to live in South Africa for a while with his wife, and then he went to Canada and the United States. So there were these links all over the world, and the idea that it was possible to travel and live very far away, it didn't seem strange at all. Anyway, I was born in Neston on the Wirral, because my parents were living in Wallasey, which is where my grandparents had moved out to. My mother's parents had been part of a very large Liverpool working class family living near the docks. But eventually my grandfather, who was a printer on the Liverpool Post and Echo, and printing was a very skilled trade and quite well paid in those days, eventually they moved across the Mersey to Wallasey. And my parents at the time I was born were living there. But the nursing home was evacuated because it was during the war in 1942. So the very early years we spent living in Cheshire. And then my father, who was a journalist, got a job on the Staffordshire Sentinel. And we moved back to his home area, which was a town called Leek, a small market town in the moorlands of Staffordshire. And I went to primary school there. And then he got another job on the Birmingham Post. And so we moved to Birmingham, and that was where I finished primary school. And then I went to a girls' grammar school called King's Norton, which I think, probably gave me a pretty good education. It was very much in the sort of single-sex grammar school mould. So if you wanted to, you did Latin and Greek and French and German and all the usual subjects.
Were there any special teachers?
Yes, there was one teacher who I think was very charismatic and did inspire me more than the others, although there were a number who were very influential. And she was my French teacher, and French was one of the subjects I did at A level. And it was assumed that I would go to university and do languages. And by this time, I decided that I wanted to do something different and out of the ordinary. So I started ploughing through the university brochures, and I came across this degree in African studies. And when I mentioned this at school, everybody threw up their hands in horror and said, you know, what on earth does this girl want to go to London and do African studies for? Anyway, my French teacher was quite enterprising, and she found out that SOAS, because it was a degree at SOAS, was having an open day. So she decided she'd go along, and at this open day she met the then registrar, who was a very formidable woman called Catherine something, I can't remember her surname, and she began to talk to her and discovered that they had been at Oxford at the same time. So she then came back and said it was perfectly all right to do African studies because there were respectable people involved. And so that was okay. So I put into SOAS, and in those days SOAS had certain scholarships for undergraduates. They had one or two competitive scholarships, and they offered me a competitive award. And so I abandoned all the other irons that I had in the fire to do philosophy or psychology or whatever in other places, and accepted the place at SOAS. And the other thing that I think clinched it for me was that the person who interviewed me at SOAS was one of the Swahili teachers, who was called Wilfred Whiteley. And he had also been trained in anthropology, although his interest was primarily in sociolinguistics. And so we talked at great length during the course of my interview, and I had already written the essays and done the exam for the competitive scholarship. And then he let out that he had a very similar background to mine, namely that he also came from Birmingham and that he came from a Methodist family, and his father was also a Methodist local preacher. And so I suppose maybe subconsciously or maybe consciously I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. So I went to SOAS. There weren't gap years in those days. This was 1960, and certainly my parents couldn't have afforded for me to take a year out and swan around. So I went straight from school to university and did the African Studies degree, which was relatively new at that time. I was one of only four students doing the Swahili branch. There were two others doing Hausa and one doing Zulu. So there were just seven of us. And it was, as I said, a very new degree. There weren't very many anthropologists in those days. The department had only recently started, and we actually used to do most of our lectures down at the LSE. So we got very fit running up and down Kingsway between Russell Square, where SOAS was, and the Aldwych area where the LSE was. So I went to lectures by Firth and Shapira and Lucy Mayer and all the LSE crowd. But we also had some of our classes, and the more class and tutorial stuff we did at SOAS. So in the first 2 years, I was taught by a very interesting character called Michael Mendelssohn, who had been educated in France and whose real passion was French structuralism. I think we spent a whole year reading Durkheim and doing not much else. So I can't say that my education was as broad as perhaps it should have been, but it was interesting nonetheless. And then in the third year, by this time, Philip Gulliver, who was an Africanist, had joined the department, and he and I got on very well, and he eventually became my supervisor. So I finished my degree, and in my final year I'd met Lionel, who was then going off to do his research in Nepal. So after I finished the BA degree, I went on to do the master's. But I didn't have any money, so I had to work my way through. I didn't have a scholarship for those 2 years, or at least not for the first year. So I looked around to see what I could do to make money, and I finally found a job in Pimlico teaching French in a boys' school, and they'd never been taught any French before, and they were, they were pretty naughty actually. So I taught the first 3 years French, and had an interesting time. And I did that on a part-time basis, and then the rest of the time I did my master's degree, and I wrote a thesis. And
what was the thesis on?
The thesis was on land tenure. On
we both did land tenure.
We both did. Quite coincidentally, the land tenure systems on the coast of East Africa and on the islands were very interesting, and there were lots of bits and pieces of information here, there and everywhere. And this was also a period when anthropologists were quite interested in land tenure. Max Gluckman was writing his famous stuff, and there were a few other people working on the subject. So anyway, I did this thesis. You had to do a 60,000-word thesis at that time to complete. And then they did give me some money in the second year, so I didn't have to teach the naughty boys in Pimlico anymore. And I finished that degree, and in the meanwhile, Lionel had gone off to Nepal, so he wasn't around during that period. And then I put in for scholarships to do a PhD and to go to work in Tanzania. I should say that Professor Wilfred Whiteley, who I mentioned already, was instrumental in getting me a placement in Tanzania at the end of my second year as an undergraduate. He knew the archaeologist Neville Chittick, who did some of the pioneering archaeological work on the coast of East Africa. And at the time, 1962 it was, he was working on an island called Kilwa Kisiwani. So he put me in touch with him, and I was offered a sort of volunteer placement with food and pocket money. And I went off and spent the summer in Tanzania, part of it in Kilwa and part of it travelling around East Africa. And when I left Kilwa, I'd come down by vehicle, by Land Rover, with Neville and his wife. But a little Italian tramp steamer came by, and they were going up the coast to Mombasa, which was my next destination. So I hitched a lift with this, and it's quite unthinkable now, I imagine, a young woman of 19 traipsing around like that. Anyway, they gave me a lift, and we sailed off to Mombasa, with a journey that took several days. And one night we were passing this island, and I said to the captain, "What's that place?" And he said, "That's Mafia." And I said, "Oh, what's there?" And he said, "Oh, people don't know much about it." So I was intrigued, because I suppose it was a kind of genre of anthropology that you wanted to find your own little bit of supposedly undiscovered territory. So when I came back to London, I started checking up on Mafia, and I went to the British Library and various other places. And it was true, there was very, very little written about it. So I said to my supervisor, "Why don't I go to Mafia?" And he said, "Yes, good idea. And you can check up on the kinship system and the land tenure system and all the rest of it." So that's what I did. So
Did you have any training before you went out to do your fieldwork?
You know, in those days, very, very little. It was assumed that you'd picked up everything you needed to know as you went along. I think my supervisor gave me various bits and pieces of advice, and he also wrote me very long letters when I was in the field, and I used to send him regular reports, and he'd make very detailed comments. So that was really helpful. But if you mean the kind of training that we put our research postgraduates through today, absolutely not. No, very, very, very little. I mean, the major piece of training I suppose I had is that I'd written, a 60,000-word thesis, which meant that I knew how to go about dealing with a sustained piece of writing. But as for arriving in the field and knowing what to do, nothing in terms of anthropology. However, what I had done, I'd always wanted to travel. So when I was 14, I persuaded my parents that I could be a French exchange could be organized for me. So I went and lived in with a French family for a month. And that was my first experience of living in a completely different world. It was Paris, and they were a very different sort of family to my own, and the food was different, everything was different. And then the following year I did an exchange with a German family, and I lived in North Germany for a month. And then the year that I finished my schooling, I went to Italy for 3 months and worked as an au pair, because I wanted to learn Italian. And the year after that, I went to Spain and did a Spanish course. And then a couple of years later, I worked on the kibbutz in Israel. So in other words, when I went to Mafia, I'd already had at least some experience of living abroad and living with families that were different from my own, eating different foods, speaking a different language. And I think that was actually incredibly helpful because I'd been forced to confront all these issues of difference and adaptation, just getting on with whatever was around. But I do sometimes wish, when I think how amazingly well our students are trained now, that some of that training had been available to me and to other students who, you know, my peers at the time. But it wasn't.
Thank you. Well, that was marvellous. Just to give you all 1 second's break, it's often nice if you can recall your first impressions when Malinowski famously landing on the beach and how
absolutely.
He was going to invent this place and so on. Can you remember the first days or months on Mafia?
Well, I think one of the things that I always feel is a pity is that very few anthropologists write about the process of getting there, because you don't suddenly go from your home site or your university to the field where you're going to do your research. You have to pass all sorts of places along the way. You have to get your permission. You have to organise whatever you're going to take with you. You have to make contact with various people, usually in the capital of the country that you're going to work in. So, of course, I had to do all of those things. And I was very fortunate because the University of Dar es Salaam was very hospitable, and as it happened again here, Wilfred Whiteley came in. He was there for a number of years. He'd been seconded there to the new University of Dar es Salaam to help to set up the Swahili department. So he was there, and that was a very good base, and he and his wife were helpful and hospitable. Anyway, I must have spent a couple of weeks in Dar es Salaam getting myself organised and finding out what I needed to find out and booking my ticket to go to Mafia. Now, Mafia is only 80 miles south of Dar, but there are only two ways to get there. One is to fly, and the other is to go by an almost non-existent road, packed in a lorry with probably 100 other people, to the nearest point on the mainland from Mafia, which is called Kisiju. And then you catch a dhow, and you may have to wait a while if there isn't one to hand. So usually people would, if they could afford it, would choose to fly. So anyway, I booked my tickets on the plane, and it was a very, very tiny plane. In fact, the planes that go there now are still very small because it's only a dirt strip of a landing field. So I remember distinctly feeling extremely alarmed because in this small plane, I think it was a 5 or 6 seater, the door to the cockpit was open, and we took off from Dar es Salaam, and then the pilot got out his newspaper and read it for the rest of the way. And I thought, shouldn't he be concentrating more on flying this plane? And of course I realised now that he just had to set the direction, and then he could lean back for half an hour, and then he, you know, he had to land the thing. And that's pretty much still how you get there. And when I was there last in 2002, for the first time, I took a video camera and I filmed the flight across and the landing, which is exceedingly bumpy. And in a video that we've made, a student and I made of this, all the stuff, the footage, that's the opening sequence, how you get to Mafia. In those days, Mafia, like most places in East Africa, had quite a large Indian community. And it also had one or two Europeans running coconut plantations. So I had been put in touch in Dar es Salaam with a family that owned a large coconut plantation on Mafia, who in turn had passed me on. And this was one of the interesting things about the immediate post-colonial period. You were kind of passed on from one person to another, and it was almost like a sacred trust. People felt that you had to be looked after, you know, if you were one of us. Then people would give you amazing hospitality and really put themselves out. Anyway, this family, which was called Stanley, passed me on to a Goan family who rented me a room in their house in the district capital while I decided exactly where I was going to work and what I was going to do, and made my obeisance to the district commissioner and so on and so forth. So I stayed in the district capital for a month, and whenever I could get a lift, I'd go about the island looking at various sites that I thought I might be able to do my research in. And in the end, as usual, it was quite serendipitous, which is that there was a house vacant in an island in the north, in a village in the north of the island called Kanga. and the man who owned it, who was an Arab trader, was willing to rent it out to me. So that was where I landed up, and that's where I've continued to go for nearly 40 years, although I have lived and worked in some of the other villages on Mafia. So that first month being in Kilindoni, the capital, was very interesting. It was a kind of halfway house, I suppose. I was very well looked after. I didn't have to worry about cooking and finding my own supplies and stuff like that. So it was a kind of gentle way of getting in. And then when I moved up to the village, I had been told that I had to have, this was 1965, I had to have a cook. And I can't remember quite how this man, who was called Salam Ali, turned up. But anyway, he became my minder, really. That's how I would phrase him. He did cook food, it's true. But he also organised things. He told me off when I was being stupid, which of course I was quite frequently. And fortunately, he knew one or two people up in the north. He was from the south, but he knew one or two people up in the north. And most particularly, he had a friend called Ahmed, who had been a mate of his when they'd both been doing the dhows. They'd been sailing the dhows up and down the coast when they were youngsters, probably late teens, early 20s. So Ahmed became a very, very frequent visitor to our house, and then I got very involved with Ahmed's family. And in fact, Ahmed turned out to be the person I eventually wrote the book African Voices, African Lives about many, many years later. So that was an important contact. But I still have I kept a diary, of course, as we had been instructed to keep diaries. And I report that on the first day I walked out into the village and I stopped at the first house, and those people have actually remained my very good and dear friends for many, many years, well, till today. And sat down and started to talk to them and ask them a few questions. I think the enormous advantage that I had was that I'd done the degree in African studies, and so my Swahili was quite fluent, reasonably fluent. I mean, obviously it improved as I stayed on in the village. But I wasn't floundering around, and I didn't need an interpreter. I could operate on my own. So that was how it started. And I ended up staying on Mafia for 18 months, although I went to live in two other villages, one village for 3 months, one neighbouring village for just a couple of weeks. And each time I'd go to another village and come back to Kanga, people would look at me and say, "You must have had a terrible time. You've lost so much weight. We told you not to go there. You should stay here. It suits you much better."
What was the central... I mean, in those days, we were told to study everything, and everything was relevant in the total studies. But what was the central theme of what you were interested in and were looking at?
Well, what it had been suggested, I've been strongly steered, shall I put it that way, in the direction of a studies of kinship, because that was the heyday of unilineal descent systems and all the rest of it. And yet there was certain evidence, rather fragmentary evidence, to suggest that this system operated very differently, that there was a different kind of kinship and descent system on the coast of East Africa. So my supervisor was extremely interested in kinship and descent, and he'd written quite a bit about it himself. He wrote a rather good thing on a people called the Ndendeyuli, who didn't have unilineal descent groups. So he said, "Come on, Pat, you know, you find out what they've got there and see if you can find something a bit different." So that was very much what I focused on initially, but as I think very often happens when you get into the field, something else also obtrudes on your notice and you just can't ignore it. And for me, that was to do with spirit possession and healing through Ngoma, spirit possession rituals. So I spent a lot of time going to those and talking to shamans and healers and diviners. But in the end, I wrote my PhD thesis on, it's called Non-Unilingual Descent, on Mafia Island, Tanzania. And then I published it later as a book called Choice and Constraint, because I didn't really think that unilineal descent was going to be a very catchy title. So those were the two major areas that I looked at in that first period that I was there.
So after that you came back to SOAS to write up your PhD. And this was a period which Lionel's talked about and many people as a great expansion of the academic world and university life and so on. Did you come back to find that you are in demand for academic posts, or did you have to struggle on for a while?
That's a very, very appropriate question. I had always been told by my supervisor and various other people at SOAS that, you know, the world was my oyster, and once I'd got my PhD, I could do anything, go anywhere. And I suppose I'd rather naively believed that. When I came back, I rapidly realized that it was actually quite different if you were female. In SOAS, a lot of my male peers were offered lectureships, or they were helped to get lectureships elsewhere. None of the women did this happen to. Now, the year that I did my PhD, there was actually three of us, and all of us were Phil Gulliver's supervisees, and we were all female. And there was another woman, Ursula Sharma, who was Freddie Bailey's supervisee. Not one of us was it even hinted that, you know, it might be nice to hang on to you. And also by this time, Lionel and I had pretty much decided that we wanted to make a commitment. And so there was this awkward business of, do you tell the supervisor that you're thinking of getting married? And for a long time, I didn't want anybody to know about this, not because I was ashamed of Lionel or didn't love him dearly, but because I was afraid that it would be the kiss of death to being taken seriously as an anthropologist. Anyway, finally, when I came back, we did get married, and obviously by this time I had told my supervisor that I was going to get married, and Lionel was already a member of staff of the department. So the question was, how were we going to organise a two-career family? Well, I wrote my PhD in what I suppose in those days was commendably record time. I think I came back in March, and I'd handed it in 18 months later and was examined, and it was passed, and that was all fine. But in the meanwhile, Lionel had been offered the opportunity to go back to Nepal, where he'd done his first field work, to do another study. And so he said, you know, why don't you come along as well, and why not have another string to your bow? So I went to classes in Nepali at SOAS and started reading up on Nepal as well as working on the East Africa stuff. And we set off we left Britain at the end of 1968, just after I finished my PhD, stopping off in Turkey and Iran. And then we arrived in Delhi and got ourselves organized to go up into the Middle Hills of Nepal, which was a very interesting and not always very easy experience. My Nepali wasn't very good, whereas obviously Lionel was extremely fluent, and so for the first time I found myself in the field in a much more dependent position than I was used to. And I just hadn't had time to read up masses about caste and purity and pollution, so I did make some awful errors that I blush to remember now in terms of, you know, how you behave, body language, food and stuff like that. But anyway, we went to this place in the far western hills called Dilek, and Lionel wanted to do a study of a bazaar town, and I wanted to work in a village. So we lived in the bazaar town, and we shared a house, but I had a little house in the village, or a room in a house in the village, where I would be sometimes. But mostly I walked the 2 miles back and forth and did this study of caste relations in this village in Nepal, and we were there. We were in Nepal for a year, but we were out of the field for a period of about 2 months because Lionel was quite ill in the middle and had to be dramatically helicoptered out. And so we had to go back to Kathmandu, and he had an operation, and then when he'd recovered, we came back and finished off the field work. And then on the way back, we met some people in Kathmandu, I think they were Germans. And we were sitting over supper one night and saying, oh, well, we're going back soon, and we'd like to stop off somewhere on the way. Anybody got any bright ideas between here and the UK? And somebody said, oh, go to Madras, it's wonderful. I'll give you a contact. So we said, okay. And in those days, provided it was within your mileage limits, you could stop off anywhere you liked. So we booked ourselves back via Madras, and we looked up this contact who turned out to be the head of the tourist board in Madras, who took us in charge, told us where to go, what to see, what music, what concerts, and we were just completely smitten. So later, 4 years later, 5 years later, when we were thinking about our next field trip, that was where we decided that we would go. We wanted to do an urban study. We didn't want to take small children, of whom we had two by then, back up into the hills of Nepal or off to the island of Mafia. So we all set off for Madras in 1974.
Thank you. Were there any, just recapping a little bit, were there any anthropologists or others who, apart from Philip Culliver, who you've mentioned, who had up to this point in time had a big influence on you, either theoretically or personally? Were you beginning to be, Lana was influenced by the Manchester group quite a bit, whether East Africanists or general anthropologists who by this time were influencing your work?
Well, I think, yes, I think the Manchester School was incredibly important, and obviously I read Gluckman and Watson and Epstein and Mitchell and all the rest of them. And in fact, recently we were rereading some of the letters that we'd sent to each other when we were in the field, our first field trips. And I said to Lionel in one letter, I have to have a copy of Gluckman's, what's it called, the one about the bridge, the incident in, on the bridge, which is this sort of case study that he builds this whole notion up on. So he must have sent that out to me. And another letter said, and can you get me Mitchell's Kalela dance? And yes, so I mean, obviously very aware of that. And then the other person who was coming into great prominence, although his tack was a bit different than the other members of the Manchester School, was Victor Turner and all his work on the Ndembu and Ndembu symbolism. And again, because I became interested in spirit possession and ritual and stuff like that, I started to read Turner quite extensively. But in terms of people that I actually met, not terribly much, not really. When I started to write up the Nepal material, I got interested in Freddie Bailey's work. And it was then that I sat down and spent a year reading up on caste and purity and pollution and all the Indian, well, not all, many of the Indian village studies, which I hadn't been so familiar with then. And certainly I thought Freddie Bailey's work was really good and really interesting. So I suppose that might have influenced a bit the way that I wrote that book on priests and cobblers, it was called.
What about Adrian Mayer and the other people at Sevres? Maintained your connection, presumably, with SOAS?
Oh, well, my connection with SOAS went on and on and on. In fact, I once counted it up, and I had an official designation at SOAS for 15 years, because 3 years for an undergraduate degree, 2 years, because I did it part-time for my master's, 3 years for the PhD. Then I was on the London Cornell Nepal Himalayan project, and that was another 2 years or 3 years, I can't remember. And then SOAS gave me an affiliation to go and do the Madras work. So I was a fellow in the department at SOAS for another 2 or 3 years. So I guess they must have thought they'd never get rid of me.
Well, we're glad to keep you, but not to offer you a job.
But no, certainly not to offer a job, no.
But were there people there? I mean, Lionel talked very interestingly about Christopher and Adrian and Abner. Were any of these people...
Well, you know, you have to understand that Lionel came in as a mature student. I was a young thing. And Christoph and Adrian were sort of so far above that, you know, neither of them ever taught me. And I didn't know them terribly well at that period of time. So they didn't, I had read Adrian's book on the village in India, caste and kinship in India. And thought it was very good, but other than that, I didn't know him terribly well. I mean, I went along to the summer parties and always felt a bit nervous and out of place. When Avner came, he was really good fun, and we all used to go to the pub together, And then I began to realise, you know, that intellectually he was very bright and his writing was extremely interesting. So I certainly read Abner's stuff. But I guess I suppose I also always thought of myself as a slight SOAS LSE hybrid because of the undergraduate things. And so I would I'd read a lot of Raymond Firth's work. In fact, I think I was trying to decide the other day which was the very first anthropology book I'd ever read. And when I went for this initial interview at SOAS with Wilfred Whiteley, he and I was offered the place, and I said to him, "What shall I read? I can read this summer, you know, I'm finished school, I've got a lot of time." And he sent me a list. And the two things that stick out in my mind are Raymond Firth's Human Types, which has been in print since the 1930s, amazing, and Ruth Benedict's The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. So I can't remember which of those two I read first, but anyway, I certainly remember reading those. And then I read lots more of Raymond's stuff. And I always thought Raymond's was very sensible, it was very comprehensible, although that was true actually of most anthropologists in the way they wrote in those days, because it was only later that they became so utterly mystificatory, some of them, and indulged in far too much jargon, in my opinion.
You say it was very comprehensible and very straightforward. Is that praise or damning with faint praise? Was there, did you find it beyond that?
You know, it's really hard to remember how you saw it. Actually, Lionel and I were having a conversation yesterday because he came and said, had I got the very first book that he arrived in this country clutching, which is Ottenberg, yes. And it's on my shelf because, as it happens, I've got all the Africa books on one of the shelves here that we own between us. And I said, "What did you get out of Ottenberg?" And he said, "Oh, I remember." He said, "I read Maya Forti's on unilineal descent groups and nearly went home." And I said, "Don't you remember one of the first times that we met? There was a little workroom in the house that SOAS anthropology department was housed in those days. It wasn't in the main building; it was in a house in Woburn Square. And there was a room that we'd sit in. There was a little departmental library. And one day I was sitting there." And there must have been some others there. Lionel was one of them. And I started to laugh. And Lionel said to me, "What are you laughing at? What are you reading?" And I said, "I'm reading Maya Forti's." And he said, "You mean it's funny?" And I said, "Well, you've either got to laugh or cry." So it wasn't that it was that difficult. It was just that I suppose I was thinking, what on earth are they making all this fuss about? And then, of course, I became one of these kinship types who also drew diagrams and worried about whether it was unilineal or chromatic or double descent or all the rest of it. But that phase didn't last very long because I suppose I got rather bored with it and wanted to move on to other things. But yeah, I mean, I still feel that if you read most of the anthropologists that I've cited, Bailey, the Manchester School, Leach, Porters, Malinowski, it was stuff that, you know, if you applied your mind to it, you could read it and you could understand it. Nobody was trying to bamboozle you with too many technical terms. I mean, obviously there were some technical terms, but I thought it was all pretty comprehensible stuff, which is more than you can say. A few people that we know about today.
Just finally on people, East Africanists, about the middle of this time, David Parkin came to SOAS, and you must have known him, and also whether you want to say anything about my colleague Ray Abrahams, who was another East Africanist. Did you know them both at all well?
Well, I knew David extremely well because we were fellow students, although he was a year ahead of me. And he kind of moved ahead more rapidly because he didn't do a master's. I did this master's in between the first degree and the PhD, whereas he shot off to the field pretty soon after he'd finished his first degree. And so yes, I mean, I'd known him extremely well at SOAS. And then we, when I was in East Africa the first time, we made contact again. So I saw him and his then wife, Monica. And he was at that time, he worked with Wilfred Whiteley, who was running a very big sociolinguistic project on multilingualism in East Africa. And so some of Dave's earliest work was around that area. David Parkin only began to work on the coast, and particularly coast, as opposed to the immediate hinterland, relatively recently, because he did a lot of work on the Luo in Kenya, and then he worked on the Giriama in the, it must have been the late 60s, when we were working in Nepal. He was working on the Giriama. And then more recently, he's actually been working in Zanzibar.
Let's move on now to your later work. Can you pick out what you think is most interesting in that work? You did the biography or life and times.
Personal narrative, yeah.
Personal narratives, some work on gender. What do you think is most significant in the work and most interesting?
Well, of course, it depends who the audience is, doesn't it? When I went back to Mafia for the second time in the 1970s, I actually went with a BBC film crew, and they wanted to use the Mafia footage. They were making a series of films with themes, or anthropological themes, and the one that I was supposed to work on particularly was the theme of gender, because by the mid-1970s there was beginning to be considerable interest in what it was called in those days the anthropology of women, which subsequently became the anthropology of gender. Sorry. So from the mid-1970s, for quite a long period, I did do a lot of work on gender, both in Tanzania, and then the first work that I did in India was on women's organisations, which was also about class and about how women managed politics, managed to get politically involved and achieve political power without doing so in an overt way through social welfare organisations. And then I continued to work on that until probably the late 1980s and even into the 1990s. And still, it's a theme which I think is extremely important and which informs some of the work that I've done even recently. The other subject that I became very interested in the late 1980s and the early 1990s was the anthropology of food. There was very little written about the anthropology of food, although Mary Douglas had done some extremely important work. But when I first tried to put together a course on the anthropology of food, I was drawing on a very multidisciplinary background. I used a lot of historical material, social geographers, cookbooks, development stuff, all kinds. And I think that's a fascinating area, because looking at food can lead you in so many different directions. I mean, certainly gender was one obvious theme, but there were lots of others. It could lead you into a sort of development direction. It could also lead to a study of symbolism and metaphors and a sort of more structuralist approach. And so every area that I've worked, geographical areas I've worked, with the exception of Nepal, which I've never gone back to, I've done work on food. In India, I worked very briefly, had one short trip where I looked at something called the Tamil Nadu feeding scheme, which is the largest feeding scheme in the world, where they run a noon meals scheme for school children and even preschool children. I've more recently done work in India on changes in food consumption patterns among the people that I've worked with now for many years, over 20 years, 25 years. So these are middle class participants, informants, and looking at the very dramatic changes in the kind of food that they eat and that's available to them, and how they do their shopping and stuff like that. On Mafia, I've been increasingly concerned about the deterioration in the food situation and the reasons for this, and this is something that I've been exploring in the latest project that I'm working on now, which is called Local Understandings of Modernity. And then in the first half of the 1990s, I directed two large projects on food in Britain, which were part of a big ESRC research program called The Nation's Diet, which was multidisciplinary, so there were psychologists and I was the only anthropologist. There were one or two sociologists, social policy people. There were about 10 of us who had projects, and I actually had two projects, one based in Lewisham, which is an inner city area in London, and one based in a rural area of West Wales. And there were three research associates working with me. In fact, they collected most of the data, although I did do some data collection myself as well. And what the projects were about was looking at people's understandings of the relationship between food and health. So we were very, very interested in how people made the choices they did, why they made the kind of choices they did, and how this tied in with conventional anthropological interests such as household structure, gender relations, the wider political economy, and how the micro ties in with the macro, and so on and so forth. So I've still continued to keep an interest in that, and I've written a bit and given one or two lectures at conferences on things like, well, I became, from the food, I became interested in the issue of risk, because BSE, the first BSE scare happened when we were doing that project. And then, of course, the second BSE scare happened, and there have been multiple food scares, moral panics, whatever you want to call them, along the way. And most recently, the major business being, of course, the foot and mouth, and then the ongoing importance of the GMO debate and the kinds of differences. For example, the hostility in many parts of Britain and Europe by comparison with, for example, North America. So I've continued to work on that, and I still, when I go back to Wales, I still, talk to people about these issues and keep clippings, and hope to write more about it one of these days.
What would you say, is there a thread or theme that connects all these? Because you are a very wide-ranging anthropologist, both in your interests and also in, as you know, for me that isn't a criticism, that's a commendation, since I have the same bias. You're just about as much an Asianist as an Africanist, and you've worked, as you indicated there, on many different themes. Is there a really something behind all this that links them all together?
Well, I think that I suppose I've always disliked the kind of dichotomy that's made between theory and praxis, or between one's personal life and one's academic life. And since I've taken very particular political positions and stances, I've wanted to carry this through into my work and not see my work as completely divorced from the issues that I think are important in my life and in the world generally as I see it. And most recently, I've become increasingly exercised about issues like social justice, human rights, ethics. The most recent book that's come out is a book on ethics, which I think can be treated as very much a sort of, Marilyn Strathern has called it a form of audit culture, where we fill out our ethics forms and the ethics committee either rubber stamps it or doesn't. Or you can actually deal with ethics in a much more profound way, which is about, what are we really doing and why are we doing it, for whom are we doing it, how should we be doing it, and those much more important questions about what and who anthropology is for. So, yeah, I guess an attempt, not always very successful, to try to bring those issues into my work.
Turning to at the beginning, you said that you had considerable obstacles as a woman in getting a job, but later on you became a very successful high-level academic and chairman of the Association of Social Anthropologists and professor at Goldsmiths and so on. How did this happen? What were the steps up the greasy pole? Steps up
well, it was a very greasy pole. Well, by 1975, when we came back from India, we had a 5-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son. And I had published two books. I'd written up the Nepal material first. That was a fairly short book because it was a series that Phil Gulliver and Dave Parkin were trying to get going to rival the famous Holt Reinhardt Winston series. I think we, you know, we all thought we were going to make our fortunes as every American university would adopt this. And it was, you know, it was a good little series. Unfortunately, the publisher was taken over by another publisher and then by another publisher, and I've really lost all track of exactly who owns the copyright on all of that material now. And then I'd also finally managed to get my PhD thesis published in 1975. And so I started applying for jobs, and it was made very plain to me, in some cases quite overtly, extraordinarily, that, you know, well, you had two children, and the fact that you had two books, you know, the children cancelled out the books. And I remember at one interview in this very city, I won't say which department, I was asked, are you really serious about wanting a job? He almost said, dear. He didn't need to say it, but... and I said, well, you know, what do you think I'm sitting here for? Of course I'm serious about wanting a job. So I had applied for several jobs and not been successful, and was extremely annoyed about it, because I could see other people that had either come along after me, or I thought really were not that fantastic, you know, making it, males mostly. And by this time I was also part of, we disgruntled women had formed the London Women's Anthropology Group, which met monthly to mull over these nefarious doings of our male colleagues and patrons, and we started having conferences and putting out papers and so on, and the men got terribly nervous. I remember meeting one distinguished Cambridge anthropologist, actually, and I was completely amazed when I realised that they were much more terrified of us than we were of them. I think they thought the revolution was really happening. Anyway, the long and the short of it was that eventually, after about a year and a half of this, getting really rather depressed and feeling this was, you know, grossly unfair, I landed the job at Goldsmiths, and I hadn't known anything about Goldsmiths. There wasn't an anthropology department there in those days. So I'd gone along thinking, well, I don't really think I want to be here. You know, they haven't got any anthropologists apart from the one person who was there, Brian Morris, who was already teaching there. And it was the other end of London, and we just bought a house in northwest London, and Goldsmiths was in southeast London. I don't really think this is the place for me. But anyway, they offered me the job, and I accepted it. And I've stayed there ever since, pretty much with obviously trips to the field, and then a period as a secondment to another institution in the University of London. And fortunately, the only other anthropologist who was there, we were both teaching anthropology to psychology students. The university regulation said in those days that psychology students couldn't just do psychology, they had to do an other subject. So we were the kind of tame other subject. So we taught hundreds, or at least it felt like hundreds, of psychology students. And Brian and I got on incredibly well, even though our backgrounds were very, very different and we were very different sorts of people. But we decided rapidly that there was no way that that was how we wanted to spend the rest of our lives. What we needed was a department. And since there wasn't one, we'd better create one. And so that was what we set about doing. So after a couple of years, we managed to get one more post. And then a year later, we got another post. And then a couple of years later, we got half a post, until there were five of us. And then we managed to get a sixth person by dint of somebody had to be away every year. So somebody had to get money every year. And then we got a sort of sixth permanent temporary. And then we went to Richard Hoggart, who was the then warden of Goldsmiths College. I can still remember going to see him and saying, we want to be independent. We want to move out of the psychology department and be an anthropology department. And he said, don't be so daft, which was his typical way of talking. And then finally he said, all right, you can be a unit. So for a year or two we were a unit. And then we started calling ourselves a department. And then I think the wardenship changed, and we just sort of, somehow we became a department. And then we started to grow. And in the last few years, the department has grown quite dramatically. So I think there are now 15 or 16 full-time members of staff, and lots of other people around, and lots of part-timers and visiting tutors. And obviously the student numbers have grown considerably as well since those early days. So that was all... incredibly hard work, incredibly interesting, a great deal of fun, I think the first five of us who were appointed at Goldsmiths were all mavericks in our way. But we knew we had to stick together if we were going to make a go of it, because those were the days when the cuts started biting. I'm talking now the mid-1980s onwards. And Goldsmiths was never a wealthy institution. So we had to pull together, you know, sink or swim. We had to do it together, and we did. So I feel that I was really very privileged to be part of what's become, this isn't just my opinion, one of the best departments in the country and one of the most interesting departments in the country. As to being female within that milieu, the person who took over from Richard Hoggart, Andrew Rutherford, his background was a Scottish Presbyterian who I think had a very strong sense of justice and fair play. And under his period as Warden of Goldsmiths, quite a number of women were either appointed or promoted. And I was actually, in 1989, the first professor to be appointed at Goldsmiths College. And I was incredibly surprised, actually, when he phoned me up and he said, well, they're going to make you a professor. And I said, what, me? you know, that it's just something I hadn't really thought about very much before. And you have to remember, I think, that in 1989, I think I was one of about three women professors of anthropology in the country. Marilyn, I think, was already a professor then, and there was one other. I can't remember who it was now. I don't think it was... It might have been Sandra. Anyway, the numbers were really tiny. It was, you know, all the major senior posts in anthropology for a long, long time were occupied by men, and things only began to change, I suppose, in the mid-1980s and then more so in the 1990s. And I think there has been an interesting demographic change in the gender balance in anthropology. I wouldn't claim that it's perfect, but it's certainly infinitely better than it was when I started out. And the kind of questions that one would be asked at interview as a woman that I've heard other people say to me, it would be unthinkable. I mean, you simply couldn't get away with it anymore. So I suppose things have improved somewhat to that extent.
Two final questions. One, I asked Lionel, what constraints, what was the title of your book? Constraints.
Choice and Constraints.
Choice and Constraints. Does being married to another anthropologist, shall we say, advantages and constraints? He couldn't think of any constraints to be glad to hear, but being married to another anthropologist have. That's one short question.
Well, I can't think of any disadvantages either. I remember when I finally got up the nerve to write to my supervisor and I said, Lionel Kaplan and I are going to get married. And he wrote back and said what a nice fellow Lionel was, and, you know, he thought that was a very good idea. But he said, I am concerned that you'll talk about anthropology over the breakfast table, which I can't say that we do very frequently. But we do talk about anthropology. We have always read everything that the other person has written and commented on it, and that's just been an incredible privilege to have somebody who's willing to plough through your early drafts, your awful prose. And especially when I was still a postgraduate student and writing my thesis and my first book, Lionel was of incredible help. And still, I respect his opinion about whatever I turn out more than anybody else. And if he says this is rubbish, then it gets, you know, as it gets changed or it gets chucked. The one thing that we've never done is that we've never worked together. I mean, we've been in the same locations, but always working on different projects. And we've both been asked a number of times, why didn't we do what other anthropological couples have done? And we said, well, we're still married after 37 years, and some of them aren't. So I think that's been a good recipe, that we've each had our own spheres and done our own thing. And sometimes we've each gone off independently and done our own short bursts of field work, and one's looked after the house and the kids while the other's been away, and that also worked very well. So I think as a woman, I've been incredibly fortunate. I can't remember, was it Barbara Ward who said once, if you're a woman to succeed in anthropology, you need good luck, good health and a good husband. And I suppose, you know, I've been blessed with all of those.
The last question is just really just to see if there's anything that, many things that we haven't touched on in your life, but is there anything else that, as they say, when they send troops over the
over the top,
is there anything else that
anything
you need to know?
Right.
I should have.
No, I feel that I'm coming into a somewhat different phase now where I'm not encumbered with teaching, which I have to say I enjoyed enormously and got tremendous pleasure from and always learnt vast amounts from my students, and it's a very renewing and energising thing, but of course it's also very time consuming. And so now having the freedom to do what I want to do when I want to do it, it's terrific. It means I can travel, I can take advantage of invitations, I can do field work if I feel like it, and I can finally begin to catch up. I think this is one of the problems that you have as an anthropologist if you're fortunate and you get the chance to go and collect data, that you never somehow manage to write up everything. Or even if you do, as you mature or as anthropology changes, you change, your perspective changes, there are new ways of looking at old material. And so this is the phase that I'm looking forward to now, which is reviewing some of what I've done or what I've collected before, perhaps moving in slightly different directions. So, still lots to be done.
That's a very nice positive note to end on. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.